created this series so that people could come and learn more about service design and journey mapping software. And our co-founder, Mark Stickdorn, right here, and us, we like to share our experience on how we can embed and scale service design in organizations. So what we're going to do today, same thing we do with every session, we're going to kick off with a little bit of an introduction on the focus topic, and just to get everyone kind of on the same page, and then we're going to give you space to ask your questions and talk about those. Mark, would you like to introduce yourself?
Of course. I'm Mark. You introduced me already. Besides co-founder and CEO of Modern Metrics, I work in the field of service design for quite a while, published some books about that. But if you listen to this, I guess you know that. Done. Let's get into the content. That's more interesting.
Okay. Let's get into the content. Okay. So I'm Nicole. Hi. I work for Mark, and I help our clients over here in North America. And I also work as a service design consultant. So hands in the weeds of the work. Today, we are going to talk about measuring service design, measuring the outcomes of service design. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the measures out there that don't always work so well, like NPS and some other things. And we're going to answer questions. I think it's going to be a hot topic. We had a lot of people sign up for this session. I know as a practitioner, it can be hard and it can be slippery. So, Mark, would you like to share a bit more about the topic to kick us off?
Before we start, two things. I promise there won't be a rant on NPS today. I tried to leave that out. It's there. We accept that. And another thing is I just want to do a little bit of self-promotion. We have a research group, actually, where you can or everybody can sign up for with a simple email to mail@smaply.com. We have some cool stuff coming up. We're going to invite you then to prototyping sessions, to research sessions, to usability sessions. Of course, you get a reward for that. End of advertisement. Let's get into the content. I would like to start with a presentation with a few slides. All right. We're going to talk today about measuring the impact, the outcome of service design. And I thought it might be nice to start with a few examples. So here are a few examples from the last years from Touchpoint, the service design magazine by the Service Design Network, and from the Service Design Award winner from 2018 and 19. So just three examples, like what do we hear about the outcome of a service design project, of the impact. It can be costs, like in the first example here from the Touchpoint Journal, 240% return of investment. With an investment of £180,000, the client saved £435,000. Great. The next one, 77% decrease in waiting time. And that resulted then in a drop of abandonment rates, of shopping carts. And that obviously results in greater revenue, higher revenue. And the last one, 41% more complaints could be resolved, and the time taken to resolve a complaint reduced by 63%. So that can be translated in a value like cost saving, obviously. And of course, better customer experience, but we're gonna get to that. Like, what do we actually measure and what do companies value? If we talk about the impact of service design in general and design-led organizations, we all know the McKinsey Quarterly Report from 2018, the business value of design, showing a correlation between how much organizations invest into design, how design-led they are, and revenue or the return to shareholders. We also know these numbers from employee experience. So that is just a little overview from Harvard Business Review from research published in 2017. A quote I like there is, companies that invest in employee experience outperform those that don't. So what they've done is they looked at different organizations, how much do they invest into employee experience, and do they find any correlations with like employee growth, with like average revenue, average profit, revenue per employee, and so on, profit per employee, and so on. And also on a, if you look at an entire market, you see correlations there. So if you look at the development of stock prices, for example, and you put the different companies into different indices, like the Fortune Best Companies to Work For, the Glassdoor Best Companies to Work For, or the selection they took for this research, you see a clear correlation there. Now, the problem about all these general thing is that it's always a correlation and not a causality, which means if you are talking to someone who's very critical, that person could say, yes, it's a correlation, I agree. I interpret that in the following way. Only the companies who are really successful have the budget to invest into that. And it's hard to argue against that because it's a correlation, not a causality. And that is kind of the level we're often talking about when we talk about it at such an abstract high level. The more we get into a project level, the more it gets concrete, the easier it is to actually talk about the actual outcome of a project. What we try to achieve is we try to improve customer satisfaction, employee satisfaction. And just as a reminder, what that actually is, academic model behind that is called the confirmation-disconfirmation paradigm, where we compare our expectation with our experience. If they match, we're satisfied. If the expectation is too high, we're dissatisfied. If the experience is higher than our expectation, we are very satisfied. So actually, when we measure customer satisfaction, it is always a comparison of these different values. We need to keep that into in our mind. That model fits also the customer journey, and I just jump over it because to increase customer satisfaction, we can work both on the experience side and also on the expectation side. So what we can do, and some companies are doing that strategically, is to increase satisfaction. Instead of increasing the experience, we can also manage the expectation. Now, where I wanted to end up with is the emotional journey, because reality is a bit more complex than this simple theory. At every moment of the customer journey, we are actually comparing our expectation with our experience, and the result is the emotional journey, a lane that we typically add to a journey map. Now, if we look at three potential emotional journeys, if we now just measure customer satisfaction once, and we try to put everything on this one value, now, my question is, when do we typically measure customer satisfaction? When do we do that? Typically, it's rather at the end of an experience, right? It is if you are in a hotel, if you had a service of whatever kind, you get a little questionnaire, you get asked maybe in a phone call afterwards, can you please rate your experience? Or sometimes you get asked, like, would you recommend us? Which is a stupid question in some areas, because I would never recommend certain services to friends, because that's not what I talk about. I promise not to rant about NPS, so I shut up now. The problem there is, if we just pick one time, one moment in time, like after the experience, and we actually aggregate all the data to just one value, like the average value, on this very simple example, if we would do that at step number 9, where we have customers who rated very positive, others very negative, the average rating is 0. And that doesn't help us to improve. So we use KPIs, we measurement often to understand, are we decreasing, are we increasing in the long run? And that also has implications on, can we actually tie it back to one particular project? So perhaps customer satisfaction in a general is too vague, too big to point it to one specific project. And that was it. That was my intro.
Thank you. Okay, so we're going to get into questions. We've collected a few questions beforehand. If you're joining us live, you can send your questions in the chat. And when you do, make sure you send them to everybody, so all panelists and attendees, so that everyone can see your question. And then we also, a lot of you already started posting where you are and what you do. We love to see that. So if you haven't yet introduced yourself in the chat, you can go ahead and do that. And yeah, let's get going with some questions. We're gonna go with a question shared beforehand. Okay, so this came in from Chu Yi. One question that I would find very interesting to get an answer to would be how Mark thinks emotional impact can be measured the best, especially when thinking about the emotional journey in a customer journey map. As a service designer, it's also about generating those signature wow moments. And I was wondering how emotions, when changing negative experiences to positive ones, can be measured. With this, I do not refer to analyzing emotions by using face analysis or so, but something that is more tangible to use in our daily business. I think maybe going deeper into what you just talked about.
Yeah, so yes, and you already mentioned a topic there. There are loads of very interesting research approaches how to actually really quantify that. I know of research projects where it's about sensors that you put on the skin to track your emotions. And of course, we know about eye tracking and stuff like that, and face recognition, as you mentioned, and so on. However, it's like, as you said, in the day-to-day business, this is not what we typically can use because we don't have either the budget or the technology to do this in a really proper academic sound quantitative way. So a few ideas there. What we actually talk about is research. And in research, we always talk about triangulation of method. If we just use one method, we probably fall into the trap of certain biases. So we should use different methods looking at the same topic. So if it is about, let's say, the experience of, going through a theme park, we should use different methods to come up with this emotional journey. And then we would triangulate between the different methods and see, do they align or is there one odd one out method? What you can do is, for example, a co-creative workshop where you put up like the big phases of a day or the big steps people go through, and you ask them to put their ratings, positive or negative, retrospectively. We've done that in a ski resort, for example, where there were researchers at the end of a slope. We had a big board next to it with like smileys from positive to negative and the phases of a day. And over a day, we just went through this journey with 100 people. And we did it always in teams of like, well, 3 to 5 people. And just by listening to the reasoning why they thought something was positive, like parking your car, and others thought this was horrible, we learned not only how the rating was, but also the reasoning behind that. And that is really, really interesting. So co-creative workshop could be one approach to do that retrospectively. We also need to focus on a contextual research method. So for that, we could use shadowing, the classic traditional ethnographic research, where we actually follow customers like a shadow, of course, with their consent, throughout the experience. And while we're doing that, we keep track on that. You can think of that like a talk aloud usability study. A talk aloud usability study is when someone sits in front of the computer and navigates through a website or through a software. And while they're doing that, they're talking out loud what they're thinking and the reason why they click it and describe their emotion. We can use the same in contextual research, where we do shadowing and the research participants actually do talk alouds while they're walking through. It might not always be exactly in the moment because they have interaction with other people and they can't just turn around and talk with you at the same time. But at least it's retrospectively right after the moment when it's happened. So when the memory is still fresh, that's pretty good. So you can put that one in the mix. And a third one could be a self-ethnographic approach. It could be a diary study. It could be autoethnography. It could be a mobile ethnography. And if you put all these three in a mix, you actually have triangulation between research method and you get very sound results of the emotional journey. That was a long answer. Sorry for that.
No, but it was a good one. And I think, I mean, what stands out to me is that there are some things we really do need the qualitative along with the quantitative to truly understand what's going on across our journeys. And if we're really just looking at a quantitative measure, I think we're going to be missing something.
What I described, you can do that in a quantitative, like in representable sample sizes even. And if you then compare like an emotional journey before you did a project and then after a project to actually show the impact, it's a very visual but pretty sound way to do that. So think about approaches like mobile ethnography, where you can easily have hundreds of people in your sample size. The co-creative workshop, if you do it like I just described on how we did in the ski resort, we did 100 people in just one day. Well, if you have the budget, do it for 3, 4, 5 days, you have 500 people. Well, that's representative.
Yeah, that's lots. Okay, great. I've got another question here. I have a story behind this question. This actually came in from a client this week, not in relation to this this Ask Mark session, but it fit perfectly and it's quite broad. I'd emailed her back, thought a bit more and emailed her again. And I'd love to hear what you have to say, Mark. So Kara asked, in working with some of your clients, do you have any insight into what a reasonable expectation is for a company in their first year of their journey mapping journey? We're in the process of creating our 2021 goals and objectives, and I'm trying to develop some reasonable performance outcomes, given that we're just starting this process. I'd greatly appreciate any input you can provide. So it's pretty broad.
It is. And it's actually also, I think it describes one of the biggest problems we have. That is often the question we get, what is the return of investment of service design? Like, what can we expect when we put this amount of money into doing service design or using a specific tool like journey mapping? And I always like to answer with a counter question. Like if I get that broad question, I ask, so what is the return of investment of management in general? It's hard to answer, isn't it? What is the return of investment of marketing in general? Well, now something interesting happens, because if you talk to a marketeer and ask this question, you will get a very specific answer. But the answer will sound something like, well, our three best performing campaigns last year were. So telling you exactly how much money did they put into a campaign and what was the outcome of this particular campaign. And that is the logic we should use in service design as well. You can measure the impact of a specific project, but it's hard to tell in general what is the return of investment of service design. So answering that question, what do they expect? What are actually the use cases for using a journey? Why do they use a journey map? What do they want to improve? What do they want to impact? And that would be actually the interesting numbers.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's interesting because a lot of times when you start doing a journey mapping exercise in an organization for the first time, and you do try to set up some of these measures, you realize that a lot of the existing data doesn't necessarily fit because there isn't a good initial understanding of the journey. And so you have to kind of figure out like, what are some things we can get a quick baseline measure of? Maybe there's just data missing. And so you're kind of starting from this place of not knowing. And so you can even measure, Lynn Vizard, who's a great service designer here in Canada, I think she's on our call today. She sent out a little email blog post the other day, and she talks a lot about the outcomes of service design and how they are kind of slippery sometimes. And I think it totally is valid to measure, our people went from not understanding our customer journey to understanding it. People in our organization know what our customers go through and they didn't before. And that's like a valid measure it doesn't necessarily translate directly into revenue right away, but I think it's a really good starting place as well. It's just realizing what's missing, you know?
Well, you have a good point there, because you need to invest first into kind of a baseline to also understand your organization better and your customers better. But as soon as you start a concrete project to fix, for example, a concrete pain point or anything, you should think about a measurable impact. You should think before you start the project, what does it actually pay into? And yeah. Maybe as a rough reference, rough guidelines, something we can learn from startups and how they measure success is what's called the pirate metrics. The pirate metrics, because the abbreviation of it is the R metrics, the AARRR. A for acquisition, A for activation, R for retention, R for referral, and R for revenue. And that actually follows a high-level customer journey map. So the more you zoom into a very specific moment of the journey, the easier it is often to actually understand what do we need to measure? What can this actually pay into?
Okie dokie. Let's go on to another question. And this one, from Priscilla. She's in Mexico, and she's asking what you think about the frequency of surveys. What do you think about the frequency of survey apply to users after getting or using a service? What would you think is convenient and useful in your experience? So I think really, like, how often is reasonable?
Yeah. if we really talk from a customer perspective, I would say the answer is zero. Who as a customer actually likes to answer these? That, like, these phone calls that you get once you brought your car into a shop to repair something, whatever. You add a step to a customer journey, and that is a step that is only giving value to the company and no value to the customer. What do I as a customer get for that if I share my information, if I invest time into that? So reasonable, I would say from a customer perspective, it's zero. From a company perspective, you have to ask your question. And I think that is exactly what you mean with reasonable. How much pain can I add to the customer to get the numbers that I need? And what do I do with these numbers? Are they really helping me then? And that is often a thing where organizations are too focused on certain KPIs and to get these KPIs and to have more KPIs and a bigger dashboard without actually using them and actually working with them. So when I work with clients, I often ask them when we look at their dashboards, like, what do you actually do with this data? Does it help you in your day-to-day work to improve it?
Yeah, I agree. I think there's also opportunities sometimes to bake it in. I'm working on a project right now, and we've just been sort of putting together, and this is really a digital context, so very UX focused, but thinking about ways we can get what we need through mechanisms that are actually going to improve the experience as well. So we're adding, but we're adding good and getting good back.
Yeah. At least add value to the customer. And I promise not to rant about NPS, but this is a topic that's no matter which one you use. If you put something in like a survey after a service, like this phone call that you get where people get asked, how was it? Be aware that whatever you measure gets done in your organization. So if you put a lot of effort on this rating by the customer, this retrospective rating of your service, I always tell this story from my car. I drive one of those big German car companies cars. And when I bring it to my shop, there were a time span of like 3-4 years, the whole shop was plastered with posters and stickers saying something like, we provide 5-star service. And they would always point it out, because after you collected your cars, you would get a phone call and you have to rate it in stars 1 to 5. So of course, everyone was pushing you towards 5 stars. And actually, when you picked up the car, the person who gave you the key said, oh, and please rate us 5 services. So we get our bonus at the end of the year. When I paid my invoice, that person told me again, oh, and by the way, I hope we had a 5-star experience here, because we all depend on that. If you look at that again from the customer's perspective, that is horrible. Like it's all just focusing on the KPI and not on the actual experience of the customer. And that is happening too often. So I would say try to find a way around it without disturbing customers and adding pain points to the customers just for the value of a KPI.
Yeah, my local hardware store has a handwritten like packing tape note by the service desk saying, fill out our survey and get a free ice cream. It's like handwritten, because you know they're getting pressure to get those surveys answered. Okay, we have another question here from Bahadir. I hope I pronounced your name properly. I'm designing services for involuntary consumers. Do you have any tips on what kind of approach one should follow for conducting research in such an environment? Consumers are debtors, and we provide debt repayment and collection services.
Yes, I mean, also there you want to measure your impact, and you always have two sides, right? You have the one side, are customers satisfied? Do they come back? Do they increase revenue? And as an organization, you think about either increasing revenue or decreasing costs. And in the end of the day, all the stuff we're doing is impacting that. And also for governmental services, costs are an important thing. So we should try, whatever we do, we should try to convert that into a number, into a graspable KPI that makes sense for the organization. And that is, unfortunately, in the end, a financial number. So I try to, for any project we do, I try to convert that into a financial number for the organization, because that is the universal language of an organization. And perhaps it's then not an increase of revenue, because maybe you don't do revenues, but at least it is a decrease of cost, or it is customer lifetime value, that people stick longer to you, or whatever it is.
Yeah, we talk a lot in government about failure waste and sort of like ferreting out if a certain way of doing something just isn't working for customers or users, so they're defaulting to some more expensive channel, and then just understanding the costs behind that channel can help you find opportunity for cost savings that are off the back of improvements. Okay, Michael asks, when trying to report out, oh, this is a good question. When trying to report out qualitative/emotional data to clients who are more engineering/quant oriented, do you have advice for sharing information in a way that is compelling for them?
Yes, do not quantify qualitative data. I repeat that. Do not quantify qualitative data. That is, don't say like 3 of our 5 respondents or interviewees said that, because then people will immediately switch to a quantitative mindset and tell you, well, you just asked 5 people. That's not enough. I saw a meme this morning. I think it was brilliant. It was a picture of a street with a big hole in it, 3 people around it pointing towards the hole. If there are 3 people pointing towards a hole in the street, what should you do? Should you ask 97 more if there is a hole in the street, or should you fix the damn hole?
So the answer is show your engineers that meme.
Well, you could, but show the hole. That's the thing. Show the hole. And that means, instead of talking about your data in an abstract, quantified way, show the hole. Show the problem. And that is often what makes people click. If they see a customer trying to use your product and they're failing, if they see them, like if you listen into a phone call in the call center where the customer is in tears in the end because the system doesn't allow the agent to do something, that is what really makes a difference. That also means we as researchers have quite some responsibility. Ethical responsibility. What kind of data do we show? Because we can nudge people into a certain direction. That's a whole topic of another discussion, but ethics and service design is a really interesting bit. Just want to mention that.
Okay. Sam asks, would you measure the service design impact on employees in the same way that you would do for customers?
Again, we're getting to ethics here. If you have an organization with just like a few dozens of employees, that can get like has real ethical implications, because that probably means in the end you're measuring like how long does one person need for something versus another. How long, like, it's strange. In general, for project, yes, I would do that. But probably we need different metrics, and you need to be careful how personalized information can get. But you should. You should also measure the impact on employee experience. Absolutely.
Okay. Evita asks, if there are several related improvement projects ongoing with overlapping KPIs, well, the service designer input is only on one of those projects, how do you measure the value of service designer contribution?
Yeah, it's called real life. It always happens. And academia, we have this in theory, this nice thing, CP. Do you remember this? Ceteris paribus. It means, oh, you can only change one thing and you see the effect of that. That never happens in real life. So it's a really good thing. It's a really good question, because it always happens. You will always have different things impacting something. What can help you is prototyping, when you focus on really specific aspects of it. And through prototyping, you might get rather clean data. Again, we can learn from usability studies, do A/B test. Like if you change something, try not to change too much at the same time, but leave some time in between, or change something, change it back again, and do another change. If possible, it always depends on the project and the concrete basis. But you will in the end always have the issues that you have overlaps, or that you could at least argue, well, it's nice, but that doesn't come from this project. It comes from a completely different initiative. And it's really hard to point it back to that. Prototyping helps you, because there you can actually create a safe environment to measure impact.
I think we have one more question in here from Farah. In the pre-service phase, what are some practical ways that companies can manage customer expectations?
Well, I just want to clarify, with managing expectations, I don't mean that if you are a company selling pencils, that you should promote pencils as this is shit, don't buy our pencil, because then no one will buy your pencil. So it means that you check in the end, what were people dissatisfied with? And if you then look at the level of experience and the level of expectations, you realize that is because the expectation was set too high. Then you can rather tweak the expectation, try to understand where does this high expectation actually comes from? Does it come from a certain campaign? Does it come from shared experience from previous customers? Whatever that might be. Practical way could be also that you look at your success metrics within your organization. Often these kind of problems arise in organization if you have very siloed parts of the organization. So if marketing and sales are distinct silos and they measure success only within their own silos, and they get like their bonuses according, like marketing, how many people do they bring us into our shops or on our website, and then sales get only bonuses for how much sales they do and not if people actually stay and come back or promote us afterwards, but only for the sale itself, then you probably will see strange things happening because people try to increase that KPIs instead of looking at the longer run that you need satisfied customers to come back and buy again. So often these problems also come from a systemic thing, how your organization is set up and how you measure success in the different teams.
All right. I am going to ask, one last question. This one came in before, and I think this is a nice sort of last question for this topic. Would you say that service design must always have some measurable impact? Or are there moments when it can be justified by pure knowing a redesign is important?
Often when you know that a redesign is important, there's also a measurable effect, I would say. The question is then rather, do you want to measure it or not? Like, do you want to put the effort in to measure it or not? And frankly, there are topics like the hole in the street, right? There's stuff, if you see it, it's broken and it's so clear, then we should just fix it. This thing of a Kano model, you probably know, about like how well is something implemented and how much does it contribute to satisfaction or to dissatisfaction. And in general, what we always should do is fix the basics first. And if we look out there at services, most services are broken. And we actually still need to fix basics. And if it's about fixing basics, yes, we know it just needs to be done. Mm-hmm. That, however, means you actually need to have management buy-in for it, and you need people in your organization to understand it, so you have the backup to actually do this. But in a small organization, you don't talk around like should we measure that? If there is a big problem, you just try to solve it.
I think sometimes too, getting buy-in for this work, it takes you sometimes from unknowing to knowing. You all of a sudden, you go out, you talk to some people, you do research in a way that you haven't before, and you realize that there are problems that you didn't realize before. And that in and of itself is a measure. We know something we didn't, and now we can make a difference. We can fix it.
It's like measuring your impact really depends on the organization. It depends on your maturity. It depends on how large your organization is. It depends how much impact how big your standing is. If you do a project, that's my last tip for today. Think about this one project sits into your longer roadmap of embedding and scaling service design within the organization. How can this one project actually contribute to that? What is your goal? What are you working towards? What is missing? Is management buy-in missing? Yes, then you probably should focus on measurement of impacts. If you have that, if it's really a clear focus, we need to fix, I don't know, a certain area of the customer experience, and you have the buy-in for in, and it's rather speed of delivery, then probably you don't. So check your organization, check your roadmap. Where do you want to go?
Fantastic. That's a great little wrapping it up statement, I think. We're going to wrap it up here. And then if you've got any requests for topics or any questions that you have, you can email them to mail@smaply.com. And thanks for joining us. Awesome. It's a great one.
Thank you. And thank you for all the positive feedback. That's really cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Have a good day wherever you are in the world. Stay safe. Wash your hands.
Stay warm.